Now, it's worth noting here that Baedeker, again, a key agent of German espionage and subversion in this country, is meeting regularly with Wiedemeyer, who's in charge of the Rainbow Five program. He's also meeting with Truman Smith, who, along with Wiedemeyer, is someone we're going to come back to in future broadcasts. And this, of course, does not augur terribly well for the Rainbow Five program. Obviously, having the people in charge of it this intimate with members of the Third Reich, and keep in mind all of Wiedemeyer's many connections to domestic and German Nazis, it suggests that the security of the Rainbow Five program was not necessarily in the best situation. Did you want to say something, Nip? Oh, okay, I thought I saw one of your hand signals there. Anyway, as you might guess, with circumstances like this surrounding the Rainbow Five program, eventually it got leaked. It is unclear to this day who leaked it, but we're going to examine the circumstances of that leak, and perhaps the best place to start would be the organ in which it was leaked, which was basically the Chicago Tribune. Now, the Chicago Tribune was at that time, run by Robert McCormick. Robert McCormick was an arch-reactionary in this country, a doctrinaire fascist, an America firster, and someone who gave very good press to the Third Reich. And McCormick was tabbed by one person, the greatest mind, one critic, the greatest mind of the 14th century, to give you an idea of sort of what how his intellectual horizons were regarded by his peers. At any rate, Robert McCormick's Chicago Tribune did eventually break the story of the Rainbow Five program, which was supposed to be a very, very closely guarded military secret. Obviously, it contained the operating blueprints for U.S. and British military cooperation during World War II. About the leaking of this, going back to American Swastika by Charles Higham, the story appeared on Thursday morning, December 4th, 1941, headed FDR's War Plans. Goal is 10 million armed men, half to fight in AEF. It's an American Expeditionary Force abbreviation. Proposes land drive by July 1st, 1943 to smash Nazis. President told of equipment shortage. The story went on. A confidential report prepared by the Joint Army and Navy High Command by direction of President Roosevelt calls for American Expeditionary Forces aggregating 5 million men for a final land offensive against Germany and her satellites. It contemplates total armed forces of 10,045,658 men. One of the few existing copies of this astounding document, which represents decisions and commitments affecting the destinies of people throughout the civilized world, became available to the Tribune today. It is a blueprint for war on a total scale unprecedented in at least two oceans and three continents, Europe, Africa, and Asia. The report expresses the considered opinion of the Army and Navy strategists that, quote, Germany and her European satellites cannot be defeated by the European powers now fighting against her, unquote. Therefore, it concludes, if our European enemies are to be defeated, it will be necessary for the United States to enter the war and to employ a part of its armed forces defensively in the Eastern Atlantic and in Europe and Africa. July 1st, 1943 is fixed as the date for the beginning of the final supreme effort. Both Lloyd Wendt, W-E-N-D-T, in the Chicago Tribune, The Rise of a Great American Newspaper, and Burton K. Wheeler in his memoirs, Yankee from the West, say that the article, which continued overly for several thousand words, did not contain classified information. These disclaimers are erroneous. The information supplied was indeed classified top secret, and its release was a matter of the gravest danger to national security. On the morning of the story's publication, the War Department was in an uproar. Not a soul entered the building without a copy of the Washington Times-Herald gripped firmly in his hand. Apparently the only personage in the entire government who had failed to read the paper on that fatal day was Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who walked into the munitions building at 7:30 a.m. to find his secretary, greatly agitated, handing him a copy of the paper. Note that, because that's going to conflict with a detail we're going to look at in a minute. The hubbub of conversation around him, emanating from a score or so of high-ranking army officers, ceased abruptly as he scanned the pages. Every eye was upon him. He was horrified by what he read. He was still more distressed when his secretary started to cry and the atmosphere became charged with suspicion. After all, he was the only man in that room with contacts with America First, Lindbergh, the German embassy, and Burton K. Wheeler. Burton K. Wheeler, by the way, was pro-Nazi and had a German intelligence agent for a secretary, even though he was a U.S. congressman. Wasn't it likely that he was responsible for the leak? However, he was somewhat mollified when his superior, General Gerow, G-E-R-O-W, assured him of his complete support. J. Edgar Hoover has already been instructed by the President to investigate this matter, Gerow said. You have my complete confidence. This breach of security is not a matter of guilt in the War Plans Division. Of that I assure you I am certain. Assistant Secretary of War John J. McCloy took a different view. Indeed, he summoned Wiedemeyer to his office and instead of suggesting he sit down, shouted at him, "There's blood on the hands of the man who did this," unquote. However, he did not quite bring himself to charge Wiedemeyer directly with an act of treason. He simply announced that when the guilty person was discovered, he would be court-martialed. Back in his office, Wiedemeyer faced a very unpleasant situation. Hoover had dispatched his number one man, Edward Tamm, T-A-M-M-M-M, to the office, that's two M's, and Tamm was standing by an open filing cabinet while Wiedemeyer's secretary was sobbing into her hands. One of Tam's men was holding a copy of the victory program. The same passages were underlined in red by Wiedemeyer as appeared in the newspapers. When Leonard Mosley, author of Marshall, Hero for Our Times, a biography of General George Marshall, interviewed Wiedemeyer in 1982 for the purposes of his book, Wiedemeyer gave an explanation of this. He said that he had looked at his copy of the plan before the FBI's visit, compared it with the newspaper's account, and underlined the passages appearing in both the plan and the newspaper. The problem was that he had stated elsewhere he had not seen the paper that fatal morning before entering the War Department. No doubt memory was failing him in old age. So, note that although the person who leaked the War Department plans has never been determined, there are interesting discrepancies in Albert Wiedemeyer's story. Recall his contacts with many Third Reich officials, his contacts with America First, and many American, domestic American fascists. Again, he was officially cleared. There remain discrepancies in his account.
Yes, and perhaps if his memory is failing him, it's interesting to know that Ronald Reagan still found him useful in the 1980s. Okay, we're going to read one last segment here and then take a break. I just want to mention that you are listening to KFJC 89.7. In Los Altos Hills. On Sunday, this is still talking about the Rainbow Five disclosures, and this is still from American Swastika. On Sunday, they were rudely awakened from their pleasant somnolence by news of the Japanese air attack on Pearl Harbor. The theft of Rainbow Five suddenly seemed insignificant, and even when Hitler made its release the main plank in his platform for declaring war on the United States 4 days later, not a person noticed it. However, Pearl Harbor or no Pearl Harbor, J. Edgar Hoover was having a field day and would not be shaken off. No doubt he would not have made his findings known to the public, even if he had gotten to the bottom of the matter. But he kept pressing against Wiedemeyer while failing to grill Wheeler or Walsh or Cavalcanti. Edward Tamm was put in special charge of the case. He asked again and again on the Monday after Pearl Harbor what security methods Wiedemeyer had used to protect the victory program. Tam's assistant, Joseph Genau, G-E-N-A-U, also cross-questioned Wiedemeyer, chiefly in order to ascertain evidence of, quote, guilt in his general demeanor. General Sherman Miles of G2, Army Intelligence, ordered Colonel J.T. Bissell and Captain Lowell J. Bradford of his limited staff to join the questioning. Again and again, Wiedemeyer went over the list of names to whom copies were supplied, and it emerged that many had access to duplicated documents. The reports by Tamm were deliberately unfavorable to Wiedemeyer. He was charged in them with confusing dates, showing unease, and falling back, quote, upon the old adage that I could not remember, and seemed to be thinking of excuses for himself and his actions, unquote. An anonymous letter addressed to Stimson and signed with the initials OSA appeared, saying that Wiedemeyer, quote, thinks and says Hitler is a savior, and after America is taken over by the people and National Socialism is established here, the present injustices in government will be swept away. These are certainly not trustworthy men to have on our Defense Commission and our war plans, and may account for the serious leak of last week. Surely the President or General Marshall should investigate these officers' real feelings, unquote. A Colonel Scobie of the War Department told Tamm and his officers that Wiedemeyer was a member of America First. He also charged General Wood, General Westerwell, and Congressman Tinkham with leaking to Wheeler information on American troops in Iceland, also an issue in the Hitler Declaration of War speech. He added that the Iceland leak was from five carbon copies of a report and mentioned that he had, quote, a report from Colonel Wiedemeyer which stated that there was no other officer present when the stencils were mimeographed, unquote. On February 19, 1942, Captains Bradford and Sanow interviewed Assistant Secretary John McCloy on the matter. McCloy, while not specifically repeating his charges against Wiedemeyer, said he thought that he, quote, might be responsible. Wiedemeyer was subsequently cleared. Stimson repeatedly confirmed Wiedemeyer's undivided loyalty and dedication to his country. There is no need, writes Charles Higham, to differ with that opinion today. Well, nonetheless, despite Mr. Higham's conclusion, one certainly could still feel at least the smallest inkling of doubt about the fact that Mr. Wiedemeyer seemed to be changing his story and seemed to be unable to explain why he had a copy of the report with the same sections underlined as were leaked to the newspaper, and yet he had not seen the newspaper at the time that that report with its underlinings was found. And in view of his connections to various other folks, it's certainly something to look at. And, of course, as we get into the next section of the broadcast and we look a little bit more at Albert Wiedemeyer and some of his other connections and the theater in which he was later put in charge, we will begin perhaps to draw at least some tentative conclusions about some of these things.
Recall also that official investigations in this country have been known to go astray. Witness the official investigations of all of our assassinations, which found no conspiracy, and ask yourself whether that can be looked upon as a final and verifiable conclusion.
Okay. Dave and I are going to take a break, probably about 5, 6, 7 minutes.
Talk in the studios of KFJC with Dave Emery for more for the next segment of Radio Free America, part two of our Aryan Nations broadcast.
As aforementioned, this Aryan Nations, in this case, a very, very broad sort of a title to deal with a very, very broad sort of set of circumstances. And we're talking about a bunch of different things. What we just finished hearing about, for those of you who are just hurrying back from the break, just to remind you, we heard about Major General Albert Wiedemeyer, who, among other things, replaced Joseph Stilwell as Commander-in-Chief of the China Theater of World War II at the very end and in the subsequent days after World War II, which will be a focus of ours later tonight. And his early days in the War Plans Division were simultaneously with helping to draw up the victory program that was going to be the slate of activities for bringing America into the war with Europe and defeating the Nazis, final defeat of the Nazis. At the same time, Wiedemeyer, while involved with this, was also a committed member of various right-wing, quote-unquote, isolationist, actually pro-Nazi groups like America First, which was actually receiving its funding from the Nazis, and was an intimate of many, many American fascists, and also one of the people urging and would be urging General MacArthur in 44, 48, and 52 to run for president. And MacArthur, as Dave already mentioned, besides having numerous people of outright fascist persuasion on his staff, had some extremely right-wing feelings about things himself, had once been suggested as the head, the figurehead of a military coup in 1934, and as Dave mentioned in one of his better-known speeches, talked about the fact that the military should not be under civilian control, and that was an outrage and an insult to the integrity of the military, and the military should not be governed by the executive branch of the government. Or, again, to put it more bluntly, should not be governed by civilians, but should make its own decisions. So, anyway, when the war plans information, the most important document in the United States at that time, militarily, was leaked to the right-wing publisher of the Chicago Tribune, attention fell on Wiedemeyer, and as we saw, Wiedemeyer did not have any very good excuses to support his contention that he was not, in fact, the source of the leak.
Okay, now, the reason why we took a look at Wiedemeyer and some of his background, some of his associates, particularly his fascist associations, is that Wiedemeyer is going to be one of the most important people in our broadcast today. And one of the reasons that, the reason why he figures so prominently is his role as commander of all U.S. forces in the China theater and as the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. Okay, Chiang Kai-shek being the head of the Kuomintang, which initially was sort of the democratic popular movement of China until Chiang took it over from Dr. Sun Yat-sen, at which point it became quite literally, as we'll see, the fascist movement of China. As such, it was rejected by the Chinese people, and Mao Zedong is certainly no day at the beach, but basically it was the venality of Chiang Kai-shek that caused Mao to be in there.
interestingly enough, as a parallel previously mentioned, Dave was talking about the fact that the Nazi Party was in fact a moribund socialist party that was infiltrated by the German General Staff and was used as an element to inject the military into the political life of civilian Germany. Interestingly enough, Chiang Kai-shek in his early days of the Kuomintang Party was, at least on the surface anyway, allied with Chinese socialism and Chinese communism. And as a matter of fact, much of Chiang Kai-shek's military training took place in Russia under Stalin, which a lot of people are not aware of. So it's rather interesting in that the a lot of these populist movements that tend to capture countries at times of great stress when people are feeling the need for freedom and equality sometimes seem to be very open to then being infiltrated by people who do not have those same kinds of ideas about freedom and equality, but use that as a base to then make their way into the civilian power structure, as we saw with Hitler and as in fact happened with Chiang Kai-shek.
As we'll see, he couldn't have wound up much farther from the tree, so to speak, than the way he did. In terms of his military training having come from Joe Stalin, we'll see how far he gravitated from those origins in just a minute. Now, as I say, the real importance for our purposes tonight is Albert Wiedemeyer's role as head of U.S. forces in China and as military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, because at that and his derivative role with the John Birch Society are basically going to be front and center. Now, the reason why Albert Wiedemeyer replaced Joseph Stilwell, who was his predecessor as U.S. as commander of U.S. forces in China and as military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, was basically that Stilwell was trying to prevail. First of all, maybe we should backtrack a little bit. There was at this time, and going on well before World War II, a vicious and widespread, well, you know, a huge-scale civil war, a full-scale civil war in China between the Chinese communists and the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek. This war continued really during World War II. There was a sort of an uneasy truce with frequent conflicts between the Kuomintang forces and the Japanese, and just how muddy those waters are, we're going to see in just a minute. And then right after the war, right after World War II, that is, the civil war flared anew. So really, throughout the entire course of the involvement of China in World War II, there was really a war going on inside the country. Now, Chiang Kai-shek wanted to marshal his forces for the coming civil war with the Chinese communists after the close of World War II, and in fact was using some of these forces to battle the Chinese during the war. Now, Joe Stilwell, the U.S. commander in the theater, did not go for that, obviously, because he wanted Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese, which was in the Americans' best interests at the time. His continuing pressures to do that resulted eventually in his replacement, and Albert Wiedemeyer was his replacement because it was felt that he would get along better with Chiang Kai-shek. This is described in a book called The Nightmare Decade that we're going to come back to. That book is authored by Fred Cook, C-O-O-K, copyrighted 1971, and the hardcover edition was published by Random House in that year. Of Wiedemeyer's succession of Joe Stilwell as U.S. commander in China, Cook writes, "During all the years of World War II, this internal enemy vitiated Chinese resistance to the powerful Japanese armies." Or I guess that's initiated. Excuse me, the word is...
I think you're right. I think it's this internal enmity vitiated.
Vitiated Chinese resistance. The page is slightly bent here, so it's not that easy to read. "Vitiated Chinese resistance to the powerful Japanese armies. General Joseph Vinegar Joe Stilwell, a field commander who came to fight, was frustrated in his attempts to get Chiang, whom he called the Peanut, to fight the Japanese instead of husbanding his strength for the eventual showdown of the communists with the communists. The acerbic exchanges between the American general and the Chinese generalissimo reached a stage where, it seemed to Washington, there was only one choice. Stilwell was relieved of his command and called home, and a more diplomatic general, Albert C. Wiedemeyer, succeeded him. But even Wiedemeyer could not get Chiang's armed forces to put up an effective resistance, and Japanese armies in the final stages of the war tore ever deeper into China, forcing American air bases ever further into the interior and away from important Japanese targets." And we would add, of course, thus costing more American lives.
By the way, I would also just mention really quickly that as a sort of a preface to The Nightmare Decade, because The Nightmare Decade is a very, very fine book that is probably available in a lot of libraries and you might want to check out. And another book that is available still, I think, in bookstores that is a very good overview on the Chinese situation from the 1920s right up until the 1940s, a very even-handed overview, but which nonetheless makes painfully obvious the same kinds of things that Dave and I are talking about. is a book called Stillwell and the American Experience in China by Barbara Tuchman, the I believe Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. An excellent book, and again, it gives a very, very strong idea of the kinds of pressures and the kinds of manipulations out of which the China lobby that we're going to be examining arose, and the essential ludicrousness of the position of people like the Reagans and the other right-wingers for years talking about unleashing Chiang Kai-shek and letting Chiang Kai-shek go back to the mainland of China. And when you read any in-depth study, you will realize how absolutely hateful to most Chinese Chiang Kai-shek and his, as Dave put it quite properly, and as Joseph Stilwell called it, his fascist government. Stilwell himself said, and this is, mind you, the American chief of theater operations in China, said Chiang Kai-shek's government is really no different than the Nazis, it's just not as well organized. Anyway, we're going to continue on with this vein in the China theater, and we're going to read here a selection from a book called OSS, The Secret History of America's First Central Intelligence Agency, by R. Harris Smith, printed by the University of California Press, copyright 1972. But Wiedemeyer had a further proviso for clandestine operations. He centralized all planning for secret services at his headquarters and insisted that future covert activities be, quote, cleared by both the American Army and the Chinese government. Okay, now these are going to be small little things, but they're significant for what we're going to be talking about. So Wiedemeyer, who had replaced Stilwell as head of theater operations because he would be more cooperative with what Chiang Kai-shek wanted, made a proviso that all Secret Service planning would be centralized at his headquarters. In other words, there would be no rogue operations that Wiedemeyer was not aware of. Okay, skipping along here. Donovan, and this, of course, is William Donovan, the head of the OSS. Donovan then sent a new OSS commander to Kunming, Colonel Richard Heppner, H-E-P-P-N-E-R, age 35, a graduate of Princeton and Columbia Law School, and an attorney from Donovan's law firm, had also been carefully selected for his post. He and the new theater commander, General Wiedemeyer, were the best of friends. They had lived in the same barracks in Ceylon while Heppner was OSS commander at the Southeast Asia Command. Okay, so we're also laying a little groundwork here. Heppner was the OSS commander in China, sent by Donovan to be the commander, also very close to Wiedemeyer, who we just talked about had centralized all intelligence activities under his control and routing them all through his office.
A couple of other thoughts in connection with that. We're not going to discuss it now, but there's a new book out about William Donovan called William Donovan, the Last Hero, or I guess Wild Bill Donovan, the Last Hero. One of the things that points out is that Donovan was very close to J.P. Morgan and the Morgan Group, which is interesting in light of the Morgan-DuPont Group's prominence in the 1934 coup, the connections to MacArthur, and so forth. Interesting also that Heppner, who was an attorney from Donovan's law firm, and General Wiedemeyer had previously been stationed in India. There may be absolutely nothing to it, but we did note that Richard Butler, the head of the Aryan Nations today, got his start as a racist by his own admission while serving as an advisor to the Royal Air Force in India. That may be nothing to it. There may be, you know, maybe a totally coincidental, the facts may be totally coincidental, but food for thought, perhaps grounds for further research. Now, remember that Wiedemeyer is now the theater commander in China. All covert operations are going through his office and have to meet with approval of the Chinese, the nationalist Chinese. Now, we're going to take a look at the development, so to speak, of the person that Chiang Kai-shek had in charge of his military intelligence. And in order to do this, we're going to take a little diversion again. We're going to go back and look at another intelligence gaffe in the United States during World War II, the early years. Returning again to American Swastika by Charles Higham. Recall now that the victory program was Rainbow 5, which Wiedemeyer was in charge of, and the betrayal of which we just looked at. Higham writes in American Swastika, deliberate or not, the theft of the victory program was certainly the greatest security breach of its time, with one arguable exception. That was the FBI-alleged presentation of the plans of the secret military installations of Pearl Harbor by an American citizen, Hans Wilhelm Rohl, R-O-H-L, to a Nazi agent, Ulrich von der Osten, O-S-T-E-N, for transmission to Louis Siefkin, S-I-E-F-K-E-N, German spy master in Shanghai, for forwarding to the Japanese in Tokyo. And Siefkin is the main name we want to look at here. Skipping down a little bit. In the mid-1930s, Roll became associated with a certain Captain Theodore Wyman, Jr., whose birth records in Kansas City Roll improperly assumed. Wyman and Roll became intimate friends. They frequently attended nightclubs, and when they arrived, so famous were they that musical numbers were performed for them by the orchestra and singer. Skipping down again, in 1939, Major Wyman, as he was then ranked, went to the Hawaiian Islands to take charge of the construction of secret installations near Pearl Harbor for the U.S. Army Air Corps. These installations included gun emplacements, airfields, underground ammunition storehouses, aircraft warning systems, the hangars, and other buildings. This multi-million dollar contract, one of the largest until that time, was naturally awarded to Roll. This was totally illegal. Only American citizens were entitled to be involved in top-secret projects. The job was begun according to contract on December 20th, 1940, just short of a year before the Japanese attacked. Constant conversations took place between Roll and Wyman in the many months following the signing of the documents. Only Wyman and Roll, and top-level figures in the War Department, had the secret plans. Security was preserved under Army intelligence provisions. Furthermore, Roll and Wyman engaged Japanese superintendents, carpenters, electricians, and builders in the company known as Hawaiian Constructors. Many of these were not American citizens. This also was an infringement of the law and a potential security risk. They built hangars, tunnels, dugouts, and the military headquarters of Hickam Field. And this was at a time when Roosevelt was fighting an undeclared war in the Atlantic, Germany was involved in a tripartite pact with China, and relations between America and Japan were strained to the limit. Roll frequently visited Pearl Harbor and Hickam Field. According to a presently well-known film historian who was working his way through college in 1941 as a mate steward on Errol Flynn's yacht, the Scirocco, many conversations took place in the saloon between Flynn and Roll when they would meet at the Isthmus of Catalina Island. Plots to leak the secret plans were discussed with Flynn. Interrupting here, Errol Flynn was a high-ranking Nazi agent during World War II, and his control, a man named Dr. Friedrich Hermann Urban, was part of the Louis Siefkin spy ring, which is front and center here. Continuing with Hyam's account, the work at Hawaii went on, and it was deliberately delayed, witnesses testified at hearings, to the point of internal sabotage. Tunnels were never closed up or properly protected, tunnels housing U.S. Army headquarters in front of Red Hill, overlooking Pearl Harbor. So incensed were the foremen and electricians, true Americans all, that they put bomb-proof shelters in by pooling their own money when Roll and Wyman refused to do so. At night, Roll and Wyman would go to the headquarters of Hawaiian Constructors at Alexandria Hall and join Japanese prostitutes at parties. Often Wyman was drunk for weeks at a stretch. So poor was the work that several members of the staff reported it to G2, but nothing was done. And skipping down still further, right up to Pearl Harbor, the work was being finished. The plans were carried to New York by a person or persons unknown as early as March of 1941. They were given to the well-known Abwehr secret agent and spymaster, Major Ulrich von der Osten, for transmission to Louis Siefkin of Abwehr in Shanghai. So Louis Siefkin, who was the chief of a very important Nazi spy ring in Shanghai, was basically the recipient, according to this account, of the U.S. plans for Pearl Harbor, which then were given to the Japanese, who, of course, began the U.S. involvement in World War II with a very successful and devastating airstrike on Pearl Harbor. And the chief of the spy ring, which channeled this information to Imperial Japan, is Louis Siefkin, and that's a person who Nip's going to tell you about right now.
Indeed, and we're going to read a short segment from another one of Charles Hyam's books, and the writing of which led him actually to the things that later came up in American Swastika and Trading with the Enemy. This book is Errol Flynn, The Untold Story by Charles Hyam, the hardback edition, copyright 1980 by Doubleday, the 1981 paperback edition by Dell. And again, referring to, as Dave mentioned, Louis Siefkin, the man who was on the receiving end as an Abwehr agent in Tokyo, in Shanghai, of the plans for Pearl Harbor, which he then passed along to the Japanese on behalf of the Nazis. Reading from Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, they're talking right now about 1946. And 1 year after the war, and remember we were talking about the fact that Wiedemeyer had consolidated intelligence control along with Heppner of the OSS during the time of his tenure at the end of World War II in China, and Wiedemeyer is still in charge in 1946. By now, China was in the grip of civil war. Higham writes, the remarkable Louis Siefkin had made a deal with the Chinese and had become head of Chiang Kai-shek's military intelligence. Okay, so here's Siefkin, the Abwehr man who handed the plans of Pearl Harbor to the Japanese, is now head of Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence, while Wiedemeyer is concentrating and refining American intelligence under his control and working hand-in-hand with Chiang Kai-shek in the interests of America.
Now, one of the, we're going to look in just a minute at why the question of covert operations was so important and why the Wiedemeyer-Heppner-Siefkin Association here is front and center. First, we're going to set a little bit of background about just what was going on and some of the unusual conditions that obtained in China at this time. Specifically, now, we're going to take a look at how Wiedemeyer set American policy in this very confused situation right after World War II, and we're also going to take a look at a changing of uniform situation, which is something that we've looked at in Europe, and we're going to look at it again right now in Asia. Returning again to OSS, The Secret History of America's First Intelligence Agency by R. Harris Smith. Writing about hopes now for a mutuality between the Chinese nationalists and Chinese communists. By the way, Yinan, Y-E-N-A-N, was the political capital of the Chinese communists during World War II. In the North, that hope was being shattered. On August 10th, Yinan announced that communist troops claimed the right to occupy and administer any city or town held by Japanese troops or their Chinese puppet forces. Chiang immediately denounced this claim as illegal action, unquote. The Generalissimo was in turn branded a fascist chieftain, unquote, by Yinan. The American position in this dispute was a model of ambiguity. Wiedemeyer ordered American forces to aid the central government armies in the reoccupation of enemy areas. Central government is Chiang's government here. They were able to provide transport to Chiang's troops and were authorized to accept Japanese surrender on behalf of the Chiang government. Note that. But, added Wiedemeyer, none of these actions should violate the basic principle that American forces were not to be used to aid the Chinese government in a civil war with the communists. Well, obviously, that's equivocation, even though Wiedemeyer instructed them not to aid the Chinese in their war with the Chinese communists, Chinese nationalists, that is. At the same time, Wiedemeyer authorized his American forces, and we're going to take a look at OSS operations in connection with this, to basically claim territory from Imperial Japanese forces on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek. Now, obviously, this was not to the liking of the Chinese communists. They wanted to be able to do this themselves, since it's generally pretty much the consensus among military historians, including actually Wiedemeyer himself, that the Chinese communists outfought the Chinese nationalists against the Japanese. But note here that Wiedemeyer was authorizing his forces to basically claim territory on behalf of the nationalist Chinese, because, again, that's going to be front and center here as we take a look at the circumstances surrounding the death of John Birch. Continuing now with OSS by R. Harris Smith. OSS officers were the first to see the absurdity of this dream of neutrality, unquote. In April of 1945, 46 OSS men had set up headquarters in an old Seventh-day Adventist mission at Sian in North China, some 150 miles south of Yunnan. In early August, the German-American colonel who commanded the group, he was selected for the post because the local Chinese warlord had been educated in Berlin, began dispatching his OSS teams into the field. These units encountered difficulties with Japanese and Chinese troops of all descriptions. There was a thin line, for example, between Kuomintang loyalists and the Chinese puppet soldiers who had fought for the Japanese. One team, commanded by a 24-year-old Jedberg, Jedbergs, by the way, were a group of OSS commandos who had operated in Western Europe, commanded by a 24-year-old Jedberg, parachuted to their drop zone to find a reception committee composed of a group of Chinese who were paid by the Japs, got their arms from the Japs, and might easily be loyal to them. The local warlord had commanded a division for the Chinese nationalist government, and when he was captured by the Japs, he commanded a division for them with the same aplomb and good nature. It was our information that he was still in correspondence with Chiang Kai-shek and would help if he didn't risk his own neck. These puppet troops were only a temporary problem. When the war ended, the warlord generals who had been traitors to their country abruptly realigned themselves with the Chiang government. The Chungking regime accepted their support as allies against the communists with open arms. OSS had also become inadvertently concerned about growing communist strength. In the last months of the war, two OSS teams dispatched from Siam to the guerrilla zones were arrested by communist troops. In both cases, the Dixie mission at Yinan secured their release. It appeared that local communist zealots had acted without approval of communist headquarters. Then in August, dozens of OSS intelligence officers were sent into the northern hinterland from Siam to report on local military conditions. Communist troops, who saw these teams as tools of the Kuomintang, deliberately harassed the Americans. Now, it's against this background that we're going to take a look at what happened to John Birch. Now, John Birch was basically the U.S. intelligence advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, okay, and not to Chiang Kai-shek, but to General Claire Chennault of the Flying Tigers. And he also was working for the OSS. And so that the death of John Birch is what we're going to focus on here. But one of the things that to keep in mind here was that in China at this time, you had a situation where what they refer to here as puppet troops were at first fighting against the Japanese, then cheerfully jumped to the Japanese cause, being traitors to their own country, and then were welcomed by Chiang Kai-shek with open arms. This obviously creates sort of a muddied situation, but basically you have Chinese puppet troops switching uniforms to the Japanese and then back to the Chinese government. Because these puppet troops are going to figure in the death of John Birch here in just a minute.
Okay, and we are going to reread a segment from, and I wrote this down and I popped this back here somewhere. I'm back a couple.
This is from The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook.
That's right, okay. Again, a segment from The Nightmare Decade talking about not only the puppet troops, but in fact the Japanese themselves, who, again, those of you not familiar with the Chinese theater, and this is why I suggest you read some of the well-known historians like Barbara Tuchman, will not be aware of the just the numerous and hideous atrocities that were performed in China by the Japanese. They were the outrage of the world before World War II actually started, and were just really famous. Millions and millions and millions of dollars were raised in the United States, but just by the pictures that were being printed by such people as the Time Empire people, the Luces and others, showing the devastation wrought in Nanking and Chongqing and other places by the Japanese invaders.
Very recently, in fact, the Chinese government has been commemorating what military historians refer to as the Rape of Nanking, which Nip Tuck talked about, and it's been in the news lately, and one of the points they made was in that one city alone, 340,000 Chinese were killed, which is roughly equal to the number of Japanese who died in both of the atomic bombings, which have been, of course, a subject of a lot of discussion recently. And it's worth noting that these 340,000 did not die in a thermonuclear blast. They were bayoneted to death, shot to death, beheaded, and so forth, in just an orgy of atrocity that, as Nip Tuck very accurately told you, just was the outrage of the world at that time. Chinese were used for, living Chinese were used for bayonet practice and so forth. So, just imagine the effect that had upon the Chinese consciousness.
And again, one of the reasons that General Joseph Stilwell was so upset with Chiang Kai-shek was because America, principally America, was sending millions and millions of dollars of lend-lease aid to Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese, who were devastating his country and slaughtering his countrymen by the hundreds of thousands. And Chiang Kai-shek instead was supporting his vast family and friends in high style, while much of the money was just being siphoned off to graft and corruption. And even more of it, though, was going into stockpiling military equipment for Chiang Kai-shek to destroy the communists after the war ended. And in fact, he had very little intentions of fighting the Japanese at all. Okay, going back to The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook. When the war ended, China was in utter chaos. Thousands of Japanese troops wandered around the countryside, fully armed, with no one accepting their surrender. John F. Melby, in a day-by-day diary he kept at the time, reflected in bewilderment upon this anomaly. On December 27, 1945, he noted, quote, "I still don't understand about the Japanese. Officially, they are being disarmed. But the fact is, they never seem to be. In Shanghai, 15,000 still walk the streets with full equipment. In Nanking, the high Japanese generals are bosom buddies of the Chinese. In the north, tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers are used to guard railroads and warehouses and to fight the communists. If you ask what this is all about, the answer is either a denial or, in more candid moments, a shh, we don't talk about that." In another entry on January 30th, 1947, a good 16 months after VJ Day, 16 months, mind you, almost a year and a half, Melby noted that, though it was being kept, quote, very quiet, there were 80,000 holdout Japanese troops in eastern and northwestern Manchuria who are fully equipped, fighting
the communists. So almost a year and a half after VJ Day, 80,000 troops fighting the communists on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek.
Recall, this is very similar to something that we looked at on the Western Front in Europe, where guerrilla groups that were set up by the Third Reich and under the command of the OKW, German Army High Command, basically fought a fierce guerrilla warfare in the rear of the Red Army as the Germans were retreating. Although originally set up by the Third Reich, they continued their war until the early 1950s, and the sponsorship of these guerrilla groups basically went to the CIA through the Gehlen Organization, now Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, which we absorbed in the end of the war. So basically, what you had here in China was the same thing that you had in Western Europe, which was a continuation of the combat. You had the Chinese communists who were fighting the Japanese throughout the war, and also the Chinese puppet troops, and then with VJ Day on August 8, 1945, the Japanese troops continued their fighting only simply on behalf of the Chinese nationalists and, by extension, the United States at this point. Ditto for the Chinese puppet troops who simply jumped to Japanese when it served them and became traitors and then jumped back to Chiang Kai-shek when it became more convenient. So the fighting continues throughout the war, only there's basically a nominal change of uniforms. But it's important to understand that there was a continuation of combat in China here during the early years after World War II. And in particular here, for our purposes, it's worth noting that the Japanese troops, one of the things they were used for was guarding railroads, because we're going to take a look at that here in just a second. Now, to the career, or the death, really, of John Birch. Now, I'm going to read you a short section here from a book called The John Birch Society in California Politics, published by the Publius Society, or Publius, P-U-B-L-I-U-S, copyrighted 1966 by Brian W. Stevens. Research credit on this goes to Mae Brussel, by the way. Mae is the top researcher in this field, and her World Watchers broadcast is aired on Sunday mornings at 9 and repeated Thursday evenings, that's tomorrow at 9 o'clock here on KFJC. About John Birch, in a chapter called, appropriately enough, Who Was John Birch?, Stevens writes as follows. John Birch was a young Baptist missionary in China when the Japanese occupied China during World War II. He served as intelligence advisor and interpreter for the Flying Tigers of General Claire Chennault until the Flying Tigers organization was integrated into the U.S. Army Air Corps. When the Army took over, Birch was commissioned a captain in the Army and continued his duties as intelligence officer for the Air Corps. At the end of the war, Birch was sent, with several Chinese, on a mission into territory held by the Chinese communists. He was killed on this mission. It's worth noting here, as we'll see in a minute, that he was actually working for the OSS at this time. Recall that we took a look at how the Nazi Party began as an intelligence front, and one of the things to look at here is how the people who are going to wind up in the John Birch Society or are associated with it in any way come from the military and intelligence communities. And take note also of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers. Those were the very famous fighter pilots who basically their shark-nosed P-40s became very famous during World War II. And Madame Chennault, really his widow, was a key element of the China lobby. But John Birch, in addition to working for OSS, is his intelligence advisor.
Yeah. It's while on one hand, the people who flew over the hump into China during the time that the Chinese were cut off from the ocean by the Japanese invasion are a justly famous, a heroic bunch, because the flying over the hump, over the mountains into China, was probably one of the most hazardous things in aviation at that time, and these were men who did this several times a week, sometimes several times in a day. And Chennault was undoubtedly a very brave flyer himself and his men, and they carried on for a long time themselves the war against the Japanese on behalf of the United States government when there was no official military commitment in China by the United States.